free people will never remain free if they are not willing, if need be, to fight for their vital interests.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem.
Praise God. Ammunition.
The Restoration Hour with Pastor Eli James.
In this present crisis, democracy is not the solution to our problem. Democracy is the problem. Welcome, everybody. Pastor Eli James. This is the Restoration Hour on Europolk Radio. Today is March 9th. We're exactly 1 month away from the big April 8th eclipse coming in 2024 with all kinds of ramifications prophetically. I discussed a few of those last night on Yahweh's Covenant People. And that show has already been uploaded, so you can look for it on YCP in the show downloads section. Okay, now I'm having trouble logging in. Okay, yeah, I had to reboot the chat room because I was typing stuff in. It wasn't showing up on my screen. And yeah, there's a small park. Let me just put it this way. Seven asks, you know, where did I observe the 2017 eclipse? It was a small park. Oh, it was about 40 miles north of, you know, the main crossing point over I-57, which was, I believe, Anna, Illinois. But I couldn't get near there because I-57 had come to a dead stop about 40 miles north. So I just pulled off and there was a nice little park with a lake and several little, not rotundas, pavilions where you could, you know, get shade. It was a beautiful August day, and there were dozens of people in this little park, and they were having fun barbecuing and stuff like that. And so I just sat next to a few of these people, and we had a great time just talking about the coming eclipse and then experiencing it. So that was a whole lot of fun. And, I'll look at on the map real quick. It should be really easy to find. But this time I plan on being in Makanda, right at ground zero. I'll get there a day early. I'm going to camp out. And, I'll be there for the duration on April 8th. That's going to be a Monday. All right, so today we're going to be talking about the Pale of the Settlement. And, you know, this is something about Jewish history that is rarely ever discussed. The Jews don't want to talk about it, and the ADL doesn't want anybody else talking about it either, because these Jews come from Ashkenazi land, Khazaria, and none of them ever set foot in Palestine until 1948, when they invaded along with the Zionist invasion, having been given the momentum by the British government with the Balfour Declaration, a totally illegitimate declaration, as if the British government has the right to give away another country to a bunch of rich Jews. Okay? Nothing of the kind is legal, but that's what happened. It was just brute force. The Jews took Palestine by brute force. And they still hold it by brute force. What's happening in Gaza is nothing but genocide. Gaza is the Jewish Auschwitz. Gaza is the Jewish Auschwitz. And this is from globalsecurity.org. And this is their military section. Pale of Settlements. And I quote, millions of American Jews can trace their ancestry to the Pale of Settlement, a large territory of Tsarist Russia where Jews were legally authorized to live throughout the 19th century until restrictions were lifted in 1917. established after the second partition of Poland in 1793 and subsequently expanded, the Pale of Settlement included within its boundaries part of present-day Poland and much of what is now Lithuania, Belarus, and Ukraine. Now, there was a time when Lithuania was actually the largest kingdom in Central Europe and possibly all of Europe, stretching, you know, from way out north through Poland and all the way down to Ukraine, you know, which borders on the Black Sea. And I forget what era, I think it was around 1000 AD that Lithuania was such a large kingdom. You never hear about that either. The fact is that the history of Europe and the 12 tribes and the nations that the 12 tribes founded in Europe is a taboo literature. Not supposed to talk about it because only the Jews can be Israel, right? So we're not allowed to talk about it. But this freedom of speech issue that the HDL, as we like to call it, or the Anti-Dissent League, as I like to call them, is going to come to a head because the Jews are trying to prevent discussion of so many subjects that they have no business censoring. It's censorship versus the First Amendment. It's Jewish censorship versus the First Amendment. And today, actually, I met with Daryl McClanahan, who is candidate for governor of the state of Missouri. He is actually number one on the ticket because it was a kind of a lottery. You just draw from tickets from a bottle or a cup or whatever. And whoever drew the lowest number gets to be the highest ranked. And that turned out to be Daryl McClanahan. So he is the candidate for governor. And several of the other candidates may have to drop out for ethical reasons. One of them is having an affair outside of marriage. That's been discovered. And I told Daryl, hey, take hope, because that's how Obama got elected. You know, he was running against a Republican in Illinois for, I forget what pitch, it's probably just a congressman from Illinois. And Obama didn't have a chance in hell of beating the Republican, but the Republican got involved in a sex scandal and he had to drop out. That left Obama to run unopposed. So I told this to Daryl. I said, okay, maybe Yahweh will arrange it for you to run unopposed. You will be the only Republican candidate. And in a state that is basically Republican, although the Republicans in Missouri are all rhinos, almost every last one of them is a rhino, so that not much can get accomplished with these people. The government of Missouri is very corrupt. The police, the state troopers, very, very corrupt. The state is loaded with corrupt judges and police officers and politicians. But the people are very conservative. And so the people expect some conservative leadership. And Daryl McClanahan will give them that because he's a very conservative Christian. And the ADL has already accused of him of being a white supremacist. And so he and I are already talking about how to counter this propaganda, this anti-white propaganda. And we'll see how this goes, because the Jews have essentially created their own argument against themselves with the various documents they've produced to protect Jews, which can be used against them, such as the Genocide Convention in 1948, because the white race is being genocided and it's easy to demonstrate. So anybody who says, oh, you're a white supremacist, you gave a Klan salute at his meeting, we've got a photograph of it. Yeah, well, what about Gaza? What about all those innocent Palestinians that the Jews are exterminating Auschwitz-style? Don't they have a right to exist? So any reporters' questions, we will be prepared to deflect and put them on the defensive. So that's the best way to approach these reporters, is to go on the offensive and make them answer your questions, not vice versa. Okay, so let's continue. So the restrictions on the Jews were lifted in 19, and of course that was the Bolshevik Revolution, or coup, I should say. established after the second partition of Poland in 1793, and that's where we learned about Lithuania, Belarus, and Ukraine. According to an 1897 census, 4,899,300 Jews lived within the Pale. That's a huge number. That's almost 6 million, forming 94% of the Jewish population of Russia. And none of these Jews ever, their ancestors ever saw Palestine anywhere near it, because they're all Ashkenazi Jews who always lived north of the Caucasus Mountains, in and around the area of the Black Sea, the Sea of Aral, etc., etc. That area there, the steppes of southern Russia, going all the way east into China. That area, a huge plain with lots of fertile fields and tall grass, etc. 5 million Jews, amazing. Okay, and 11.6% of the total population of this area. Okay, so that's a huge percentage of Jews. Usually the percentage of Jews in any population is usually 2 or 3%. Because of the substantial Jewish population, the area contains the largest concentration of Jewish historic sites in the world, despite the destruction in the Second World War and during the Communist era. Well, the Communist era didn't destroy any Jewish sites at all. They only destroyed Christian sites. Large areas to the east and south have somewhat different traditions and history. In these areas, in many cases settled by Jews only in the 19th century, large populations survived the Second World War and continue today. Despite emigration from Ukraine, several cities, including, Dnipropetrovsk, Kiev, and Odessa, located within the Pale of Settlement, and Kharkiv, which was not, have substantial and active Jewish communities today. None of these Jews ever saw Palestine. The Pale of Settlement was an area of 25 provinces of Tsarist Russia, within which Jews were allowed to live, outside of which they could reside only with specific permission. Some Jews within the boundaries of the Russian Empire and the USSR had a historic connection dating back to a fairly remote period. Jews first appeared in Eastern Europe several centuries before the birth of Christ. Now, this is true. We have a while back, we did a show about not Ethiopian Jews, but Yemeni Jews who were working along the Silk Road. And they would travel down to Yemen from the Silk Road to trade down there. And then they would go back up to the Silk Road to points east, usually, to trade in China. And so these Yemeni Jews were already in Khazaria, like it says here, by the first century AD and possibly even earlier. Okay. But the people we know as Jews today were not Judah. They are Edomite Jews. But there were Babylonian Jews already, going way back, you know, even before the Kingdom of Babylon. We have the Sephardim, who were living in a suburb of Babylon and who, you know, practiced the Babylonian Talmud already in 700-800 BC, and many of those migrated over to Palestine and merged with the Edomites there to become known, the Jews that we know today, the Edomite Jews, the Sephardic Jews. Okay, by the first century AD, Jewish settlements existed along the northern shores of the Black Sea. In the 8th century, the descendants of these early Jewish settlers converted to the nomadic Turkic Khazars to Judaism. Jewish communities existed in Kiev and other cities of Kievan Russia. And it has been documented that a largely Jewish ruling elite of Khazar Empire dominated the steppes between the Don and the Volga between 740 and 970 AD. 740 was the year of the conversion of the Khazars to Judaism. They were destroyed, however, during the Mongol invasion in the 13th century. However, many of them must have fled to Poland from there rather than have to fight the Mongols. However, the main history of Soviet Jewry begins with the reign of King Casimir III of Poland. He invited Jews undergoing difficulties in Germany at that period to settle within his dominions. Persecuted in Western Europe, for victimizing peasants, Jews began migrating to Poland in the 14th century, and from there they moved to the present-day Lithuanian, Ukrainian, and Belarusian republics. Now, basically here, this is the downfall of Poland, but there was actually, even before then, around the year 1000, 1040, 1050, something like that, the king of Poland at that time invited Jews to be tax collectors and liquor producers and dispensers, tavern owners, and that sort of thing. And because the king would get his cut from the tax collections, the Jews would get their cut, and everybody was happy except the Polish people, who became pauperized by this entire system. In 1386 came the Jagiellonian Union of Poland with the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. Duke Vytautas, the ruler from 1392 to 1430, encouraged Jewish settlement in the Lithuanian parts of the combined state headed by his uncle. At the beginning of this period, these included all of present-day Belarusia and extended as far as Kiev. By the end, they had temporarily reached the Black Sea. This action may be looked upon as an attempt to import a middle class, for the most part previously non-existent, in these regions. Well, I'm sure it was nothing but peasants all over this area. You have basically the nobility and the peasants. It's part of the feudalistic system of Europe. And this made the peasants of Europe, including in Russia, especially in Russia, very much illiterate peasants, easily victimized by Jewish moneylenders, you know, who like gypsies traveling in their wagons would lend money to poor peasants and say, okay, we'll take your crop as collateral, and if you can't pay back, then we'll take all your property, right? So that's how these Jews operated, and the peasants became even more pauperized than they had already been under feudalism. So this is the history of Eastern Europe and how the Jews have pauperized peasantries all over the place. Okay. All right, I had to refresh here again to see what's going on in the chat room. And so here we go. So, okay, so it looks like they're getting into the tavern business. A single government structure united the two parts of Poland-Lithuania after 1569. And by this time, it held the principal Jewish population of Europe. The northern half of Italy, parts of Germany, and Avignon were the only other Christian domains where Jews were allowed to practice their religion. In 1648, Ukrainian peasants, led by Bogdan Khmelnytsky's Cossacks, rose against the Polish gentry. Directed primarily at the landlords, a secondary target of the revolt was the Jews, who were considered in league with the Poles, as I just explained. The nobility hired the Jews to do their dirty work for them, like tax collecting and probably a little bit of enslavement going on here as well, money lending and selling vodka to the peasants and brewing vodka and running the taverns in the towns. That's what the Jews were doing. By the mid-17th century, Jews numbered in the hundreds of thousands, although initially they were under royal protection and enjoyed communal autonomy. Life for the great majority of Jews in Poland worsened, and they became as oppressed as Poland's Christian subjects. Well, for one thing, there were too many Jews. You know, 5 million Jews, 5 million parasites would require 50 million host people to feed off of them, and there just weren't enough hosts to feed off of. So the Jews couldn't possibly sustain themselves with such a small host population. Forbidden to own land, many Jews served as estate managers. There you go. That's one of their functions, estate managers. And as middlemen between Catholic Polish landowning nobility and the Orthodox Ukrainian and Belarusian enslaved peasants living on the nobles' estates. And so this is how the middleman industry began, and how Jews, they will always find a niche so that they can trade between two Christian groups, exploiting both. On the estates, they often collected taxes for the nobles, controlled the sale of salt and fish, ran the grain mills, and acted as overseers of peasant labor. Jews also owned the local village taverns, as I just said, okay? So all the good stuff was run by Jews. Particularly, and this is called persecution, folks. Oh, the Jews, they had it so rough. So rough. Particularly insidious was the Polish Catholic nobles' practice of making the Jews collect taxes on Orthodox churches. Well, somebody has to do it, and the Jews were well paid, right? And now, I don't know why the Catholic nobles would use Jews to do this instead of their own military. Maybe it's because none of the nobles really wanted to do that. They didn't want to be known as tax collectors, so they hired Jews to do it. And as long as the Jews were protected by the military, rather than being attacked, you know, like here in America, the revenuers, when the revenuers went into the deep south, they didn't live to tell about it. As a result, in addition to disliking them as foreigners and non-Christians, the peasants held Jews directly responsible for their oppressed and miserable lives. Yeah, well, they were right there oppressing them by collecting taxes from them, selling them liquor, getting them hooked on vodka, and making their lives miserable. Right? These early resentments were the seeds of primitive anti-Judaism, because these Ashkenazi Khazars are hardly Shemites in Eastern Europe and later in the Russian Empire. When the Orthodox peasantry joined the Ukrainian Cossacks in the mid-17th century in revolt against the Poles and the Catholic Church, thousands of Jews were also killed. Well, they were the hirelings of the nobility. And this is something most people simply do not understand, that the nobility of these various nations were just as guilty. They were actually in league with the Jews against their own people. Just as today, Joe Biden is in league with the Jews against the American people. So is Donald Trump. So are virtually all of the politicians. There's hardly a politician in America who isn't in league with the Jews, putting the bandit state first and America last, and doing everything they possibly can for the Jews against the interests of the American people. So this is nothing new, folks. Absolutely nothing new. For a dozen years, Khmelnytsky's army and other Ukrainian and Russian and even Polish irregulars rampaged through the Polish kingdom. When Russian armies swept into Polish-Lithuanian territories following Muscovy's alliance with the Ukrainian Cossacks in 1654, they killed additional thousands of Jews. Yeah, because the Jews were middlemen for the Poles against the peasants. It's typically the peasants who hate the Jews. The same thing is true in Spain, in Catholic Spain. It was the peasants who complained bitterly to the nobility and to Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand. The Jews are exploiting us. What are you going to do about it? The Jews had infiltrated the Catholic Church, and they were oppressing the people, pretending to be Catholic priests, etc. And the peasants could tell a Jew from a Catholic. Today's white people can't tell an ox from a hole in the ground. And so, but those people could. They could smell a stinking Jew a mile away. They could follow him through the secret Saturday night services they had, right? They knew what was going on. The peasants understood what was going on. And they knew that the Jews were exploiting the peasants on behalf of the nobility. This is always the way it worked. The nobility essentially hired the Jews to do this kind of dirty work, but the Jews did the job so well, especially running the grain mills and the liquor mills, that the Jews became filthy rich in the process. I can understand the resentment of the peasants. I really can. And it's even true in the Soviet Union, where the Jews ran the government and the Russian people were their serfs. One of the favorite sayings from that civilization, if you can call it a civilization, is the commissars, workers would say, the commissars pretend to rule and we pretend to work. So the Russian army, some 700 Jewish communities were destroyed in this process here, and untold thousands fled the war-ravaged areas. But, you know, of course, you were complicit with the government that now is being attacked from outside. So what can you, what are you complaining about? You were complicit. A treaty in 1667 restored most of Poland's former territory. Kiev and the northeastern Ukraine became quasi-independent under Russian control. Now, the article doesn't seem to talk about a very important fact. Namely, a lot of the Polish nobility, and this was true of the Russian nobility as well, would, if they were unhappy with the king of the country, say in Poland or in Russia, they would make secret deals with the nobility of other countries and, have treasonous activities against their own king. And so you have these third party deals working against the kingdom that they were supposed to be supporting. So this kind of treason was going on, in countries like Russia and Poland. But you also have to suspect that if this kind of activity was going on, some Jews may have been behind it, right? Promising the nobility, hey, we'll make you some money if you join this coalition against the king of Russia. And that kind of thing happened. I'm trying to think what these Russian Bolivar, I think they were called. I forget what the Russian nobility was called. But not all of the Russian nobility was faithful to the Tsar. And if they weren't faithful to the Tsar, they could, through nefarious and treasonous activity, make life miserable for the Tsar. So this happened all the time, folks. It wasn't like the feudal system was a well-oiled machine. A lot of the nobility actually resented having to provide horses and saddles and soldiers, from their own peasantry to fight a war. But if your country is being invaded by Mongols and you're unwilling to fight for your for your country and for your people, what good are you? A lot of that went on in France as well, where the French nobility, they wanted to keep what they had, didn't want to fight in France's wars. So we have a lot of treason going on, even in the feudalistic system. It was not a happy time, folks. Not a happy time, especially for the peasants. Not happy at all. All right, let's continue. Claims that 100,000 to 500,000 were killed in the Khmelnytsky massacres have been refuted by contemporary Jewish scholars. Quote, it is very difficult to determine the totals of Jewish casualties. Well, the Jews always exaggerate their casualties, like 6 million versus zero. It is very difficult to determine the totals of Jewish casualties in the years 1648 to 1649. There is little hard data on the number of Jews in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth even for the occasional quiet years of the 17th century. In the great confusion and turmoil of the war years, certainly no one had time to keep careful demographic records, and that happens during all wars, to note the numbers of deaths in each location or to record the circumstances, especially when the vast majority of people are illiterate. It seems that at the beginning of 1648, there were about 40,000 Jews in the affected region. So they multiplied that by 10. 40,000 becomes 500,000 in the affected regions. It is clear that thousands were killed, thousands fled, and possibly several thousand were captured and sold as slaves in the Ottoman Empire. There you go. Jews sold as slaves to Muslims. Some Jews converted to Christianity and saved their own lives. Well, you know what that means, the conversos, fake converts, crypto Jews. What is not clear is how many fell into each category. It appears to be safe to say that most Jews fled and less than half or fewer than 20,000 died, very possibly much less than half. So, here's a Jew refuting these outrageous claims that between 100,000 and 500,000 Jews were killed. He says, well, maybe less than 20,000. And that's probably a good number for the so-called Holocaust. In 1772, a weakened Polish state was forced to concede considerable parts of its territory to its powerful neighbors. Now, here again, we have to say that the Polish nobility was the author of its own demise by giving its hireling Jews so much power. You know that the Jews had, you know, conspiracies against the nobles of Poland to steal their wealth, to get them hooked on alcohol and gambling and that sort of thing. The sheer boredom of noble life is something that has to be considered, because these people had become very, very lazy in the letting the serfs do all the work for them. And some of the legal rights of the landlords were really quite objectionable. Like, many of the landlords had the right of first use. If a serf married a girl, then the noble had the first right to have sex with her before her real husband did. That kind of stuff. And that goes on wherever you have slavery. So, let me start this again. A weakened Polish state was forced to cede considerable parts of its territory to its powerful neighbors, Prussia, Austria, and Russia, primarily due to their own corruption, this Polish state. And typically, countries collapse out of their own corruption. The Russians acquired the area of northern and eastern Belorussia around Vitebsk and Mogilev, together with a bit of estate Latvia, or East Latvia. Although Jews have been expelled from Russia in 1742, the subsequent incorporation of Polish territory as a result of the partition of Poland meant that by the end of the 18th century, Russia had the largest Jewish community in the world. Oh man, those poor Russians, they had no idea of the parasitic people they were absorbing. Come on, let them in. Let the parasites in. Let them in. Oh, my goodness. What a horrible mistake. Let the cockroaches in. Let the Marranos, that's swine, let them in. Let the hyenas in. We can handle it. Yeah, sure you can. And that's when the assassinations begin. So, continuing here, although Jews had been expelled from Russia in 1742, the subsequent incorporation of Polish territory as a result of the partitions meant that by the end of the 18th century, Russia had the largest Jewish community in the world. The large Jewish population of the new territories was looked upon as a threat by the government of Catherine II. There you go. Of Austria. Oh, no, wait a minute. Catherine. No, she was Russia. Sorry. She was Russian. I'm thinking of somebody else. I think there was another Catherine in Austria. Anyway, in 1791 to 1792, Empress Catherine II initiated the creation of the Jewish Pale, the territory where Jews were allowed to settle and pursue a wide range of economic activities. This policy had apparently been the practice for the preceding 20 years. Jews were forbidden to move from these formerly Polish provinces into the rest of the Russian Empire. That was a very wise decision by Empress Catherine. The Tsarist government prohibited Jews from living anywhere except in the area known as the Pale of Settlement, which included, this is a huge area. At least the size of New Jersey, right? You need more room than New Jersey, which included the Baltic. Yeah, what we need is hosts for our parasitic activities. Most of the Ukraine and Belarusia and the northern shore of the Black Sea. The third partition of Poland, gobbling up the remainder of Poland, followed in 1795, bringing under Catherine's rule Lithuania, western Belarusia, and the Volhynia region of the northwestern Ukraine, and, of course, even more Jews to be bottled up in the Pale, okay? So let's gather up all the Jews and shoehorn them into the Pale and never let them out. It's like stuffing the genie into the bottle. And we're not talking about a good genie here. We're talking about an evil genie being stuffed into the bottle called the Pale. As for the Russian people, an impenetrable wall continued as therefore to keep it apart from the Jewish population. Very wise decision. To the inhabitants of the two Russian capitals and of the interior of the empire, the Pale of Settlement seemed as distant as China. While among the Russians living within the Pale, the sparks of former historic conflagrations, the prejudices of the ages and the unenlightened notions of days gone by were still glimmering beneath the ashes. So, in other words, the Russians could voluntarily live in this area. So it's not like the Jews were starving in this area. They had thriving businesses. Where'd they get the money to stir up revolution? I'm sure the Jews were still practicing their banking practices, even on each other, as well as the peasantry that lived, the non-Jewish peasantry that still lived within the Pale. Soon after the beginning of the 19th century, Alexander I ordered Jews to take surnames. These, as a rule, originated from the names of places where Jews lived, says Minitsky from Minitsia, Zaslavsky from Zaslavy, or from the occupation Sofia Reznik. Often surnames reflected a religious characteristic. For example, families of Levite origin took the surnames Levitin, Levin, Levitansky, Levitan. There's no possibility of an actual Levite being of Ashkenazi origin, folks. No possibility whatsoever. There were similar origins for Kogan, Kagan, Shkoyhet, and other names. Many of the most important Jewish thinkers of the modern age were born in those cities. In Kiev and Odessa, for example, the Jewish Enlightenment movement known as the Haskalah, which is basically Jewish witchcraft and mysticism, found some of its earliest support. These cities were also the home of such famous Yiddish and so supposedly Hebrew writers as Sholem Aleichem, I.L. Peretz, Jabotinsky, Mendel Mocher Sepharim, as well as important Zionist figures such as Leo Pinsker, Ahad Haham, and Vladimir Jabotinsky. The Haskalah movement also took hold in western central Ukraine, where, for example, Khotyn's Jewish population grew after Bessarabia became part of Russia in 1812. By mid-century, it had become a center for Haskalah and even had private schools for girls. So it's not like they were suffering in the Pale. They had plenty of Jewish activities they could do They could sell used goods. They could lend money. They had all kinds of activities going on. But the Jews didn't like to be ruled over by Christians. That's why they started assassinating the Christian leadership. In 1817, the Jewish Pale was ratified as the territory where Jews could live in shtetls only, and a shtetl, I guess, is a small village, mainly on the lands of Galicia, Volyn, and Podolia. Ukraine, as a part of the Pale of Settlement, was densely populated with Jews. All the territory of so-called Slobozhanshchina, Kharkiv, Katerinoslav, Luhansk, and others, was, however, an area where Jews were prohibited from settling. In big towns such as Kiev, Kharkiv, and Odessa, however, Jews were allowed to live if they met certain financial and social qualifications. Thus, despite many restrictions, Jews played a prominent role in the development of commerce and industry in the region. There you go. Not like they were suffering. And especially in the growth of its major cities such as Kiev, Odessa, and Kharkiv. It is worth noting that the Jews were excluded from most of the dominantly great Russian-speaking regions. They were allowed to settle in Ukraine, Belarusia, Lithuania, Romanian-speaking or Polish-speaking areas. In the territorial redistribution that followed the Napoleonic Wars, the Russian Tsar was assigned the Kingdom of Poland with nearly half of the Polish population of that era, about 3 million Poles and 300,000 Jews. Poland, especially at first, was governed more liberally than Russia proper, and conditions for Jews never became as onerous as in other Tsarist territories. For this reason, there was a flow of Jews into Poland from the rest of the Pale, which amounted to a refugee movement at times when the Tsar undertook repressive measures. And the repressive measures are actually prohibitions on Jews from lending money to peasants, taking advantage of peasants, etc., etc. About 1.5 million Jews lived in the Russian Empire in the beginning of the 19th century. Confined within the Pale of Settlement, they were subjected to stringent anti-Jewish regulations. Ah, great! They didn't use the word anti-Semitic. Although for the next century, restrictions on Jews were periodically eased, they were reimposed or even made harsher during the frequent periods of reaction that followed. After the stabilization of Russia's European frontier in 1815, the problem of regulating the somewhat unwieldy Russian Empire was the primary concern of the government. Yes, with all of these multifarious types of ethnic people in the territory of Russia, which they had absorbed, including Poles, Belarusians, Ukrainians, Jews, and others, Lithuanians as well, you could see it's going to be a difficult proposition to govern such a multicultural area, especially with Jews prominent in most of these areas. This was particularly true of the region of Nicholas and the reign, rather, of Nicholas I, 1825 to 55. One of his first measures against Jews was to bar them from a 30-mile belt in border and coastal areas, not only as residents, but even as traders. Nicholas I promoted forced induction of Jewish youth into military service. Oh, no! Impressment of Jews into the military, where they were often coerced into being converted to Christianity. Jewish rights to lease land and keep taverns were rescinded. Good for Nicholas! Yeah, he was a reformer. And the Pale of Settlement was reduced in size. The communal self-management, I bet Nicholas I was assassinated. The communal self-management, I smell assassination coming. The communal self-management allowed to Jews in Poland was abolished in 1843. A special program of military conscription was instituted in order to separate Jewish recruits from Judaism. There you go. That's hard to do, though. It's hard to separate the hyena from hyenaism, suggested perhaps by the de-Christianized Janissaries of the Turkish Empire. Very interesting. Well, who were the Janissaries? The Janissaries were white Christian boys enslaved by Turkish Muslims and impressed into military service on behalf of Islam by the Turks. So by the de-Christianized Janissaries of the Turkish Empire. Not sure what group that is actually referring to, because the Janissaries I'm aware of were young boys kidnapped from Europe and impressed into military service on behalf of the Muslims. So, you know, they were kidnapped at such a young age, there's no way they could have been de-Christianized, if that's what the author intends to say here. However, the reign of Alexander II brought a relaxation of the restrictions imposed on the Jewish population. Some Jews were permitted to settle outside the pale of settlement to attend universities and to enter government service. Oh, no. Okay, Alexander II, big mistake. Permission to settle outside the pale was extended first to wealthy merchants. Now, how'd they get wealthy? I thought they were persecuted. Then to those who had completed the higher education, notoriously difficult for Jews to secure at that time, but you know, if they became wealthy merchants, they could pay for the education of their sons. To skilled craftsmen considered important in the Russian cities, and to those who had fulfilled the 25 years of military service then required of conscripts. Wow, that's a long time. After the I was fed up after a year in Vietnam. After the assassination of Alexander. See, now the liberal was the one who got assassinated. He just wasn't liberal enough. After the assassination of Alexander II, however, the old restrictions were reimposed, and I can understand why. And persecution, or that is, the restrictions upon Jews, continued until the February Revolution of 1917. In 1882, Jews in the Pale were barred from villages and the ownership of agricultural land. Government sanctioned pogroms against Jewish communities, during which Jews were beaten or killed and their personal property destroyed, were particularly brutal. Now, this is a misstatement here. None of these pogroms were government sanctioned. The government was actually trying to prevent these pogroms. These were peasant uprisings against the hated Jews. That's what they were. As I told you earlier, the problem in Poland and other countries was that the nobility was working with the Jews to oppress the peasantry. And the same thing was true in Russia. These are not government-sanctioned pogroms. These were peasant uprisings against the Jews who finally had enough of the oppression imposed upon them by Jewish moneylenders, Jewish alcohol dealers, Jewish tavern owners, Jewish tax collectors, etc. The pogroms were led by the Black Hundreds, an officially sanctioned reactionary group composed largely of civil servants. I've never heard of the Black Hundreds. So if civil servants got involved, that meant they were there to protect the peasantry. Pogroms became frequent in cities both inside and outside the Pale, and were generally felt to be condoned by the state. Well, generally felt does not mean they were. Many of the Jews living east of the Pale were from time to time forced to return there, particularly in 1891. According to Tsarist Russia's only census in 1897, all but 300,000 of the 5 million Jews lived within the confines of the Pale. So they were doing all right inside the Pale. Many rich merchants. The principal response to worsening conditions was massive migration to the United States. Oh, no! Eventually bringing well over a million Jews from Russia, many of them communists, most of them communists. 125,000 in the peak year of 1906. Zionism also gained a following, and modern secular writing in Hebrew began to appear. Many Russian Jews were involved in the political ferment of the times, leading to the formation of the Revolutionary and Anti-Zionist Bund in 1897. I don't believe for one second that the Bund was anti-Zionist. That is nothing but propaganda. The pretense that Jews argue against one another. No way, no how. That's Jewish propaganda designed to convince you that the Jews themselves were fighting amongst themselves. No, they weren't. Communist Jews were always working for rich super-capitalist Jews, Jewish moneylenders. That has always been the case, and it's still the case today. In 1914 to 1916, fearing their disloyalty, the government moved 600,000 Jews from the border areas to points farther in the interior. In 1917, about a month after the provisional government was established, it declared the legal equality of Jews with all other Russian citizens. Oh, boy. Big mistake there. After the October Revolution, a Bolshevik commissar decreed that Jews were a nationality. Somewhat uncharacteristically, Lenin accepted this classification. Well, that's what they were. They were they are different people, a different, completely different breed from Europeans. Lenin accepted this classification, although it went contrary to his own opinion that a nationality must have a territory. The following year, the Soviet government outlawed anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism. A number of prominent Bolshevik were of Jewish, or most of them, the vast majority of them were of Jewish origin. And by the end of the Civil War, the sympathies of the Jews were generally red. Yes, almost 100% red. After World War I, nearly half the pre-war Jewish population ended up in Poland. Poland again. Poor Poland. Waves of Jews coming and going in and out of Poland nonstop. Lithuania, Latvia, and/or Romania. Released from residence restrictions, many Jews within the Soviet Union migrated to the large industrial cities, particularly to Moscow, Leningrad, and Kiev. Now, this fulfills our perception of Russia in those days, where the vast majority of Judeo-Christians believe that Gog and Magog are Russia. No, Gog and Magog are the Jews who lived in these areas. That's Gog, the Khazars, the Ashkenazi Khazars who lived in these areas. So we're being told really here that nearly half the pre-war Jewish population ended up in Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, or Romania, and of course, Kiev, Ukraine, the Black Sea region. This is Khazaria, folks. This is Khazaria, and that's Gog and Magog. Released from residence restrictions, many Jews within the Soviet Union migrated to the large industrial cities, particular to Moscow and Leningrad and Kiev. A cultural movement developed focusing on the Moscow Yiddish art, theater, and producing a large number of books and journals in Yiddish. See, they're so oppressed. They had their own language and their own theaters. Soviet anti-religious policy made traditional Jewish education impossible. Well, that's not true. Communism is Jewish to the core. By the time of World War II, about three-quarters of the 3 million Soviet Jews still lived in areas that had formed part of the Pale of Settlement. When the German troops attacked in 1941, there was a mass exodus to the east, including in particular Soviet Jews and Jewish refugees from Poland and other countries overrun by the Nazis. Of the 20 million Soviet war dead, about 1 million were Jews. The exterminated. Well, I mean, what about the other 19 million? Were they not also exterminated? No, only Jews get exterminated. Those who died in the hardships of evacuation, not like the other Russians had hardships, civilian casualties of bombing, shelling, and strafing, and large numbers killed fighting in the Red Army. During the war, the anti-religious stance of the government was considered relaxed, and the Jews, as well as others, met fewer obstacles to practicing their religion than at any other time since 1917. Well, there was a war going on, and they didn't have the power to oppress the people, that is the Soviet government, like they formerly did. So you can see that there are a lot of interesting historical details in such an article, but it's all written from the poor persecuted Jews' perspective. Everything is poor persecuted Jews, when even the authors themselves say, well, they were thriving in the Pale. They had businesses, they had theaters, they had all kinds of stuff going on. It wasn't like they were suffering horribly. And there were still Russians and Poles and Lithuanians and Ukrainians they could exploit, parasitize. So the reality is that these Jews were not suffering at all. Sure, there were a lot of poor Jews because a lot of Jews refused to work. They refused to work, period. They refused to farm. They can't farm. So you're going to have a lot of poor Jews everywhere. Not all Jews are rich. But they have to have poor Jews in order to claim to be oppressed. So the poor Jews always serve that purpose of propaganda. This is the reality. But here you see that this article says absolutely nothing about how Jewish moneylenders roamed the countryside, pauperizing the peasants and depriving them of their property. Nothing about that. And you'll never hear anything about that in any mainstream articles. So this is military or globalsecurity.org/military. So, and typically military historians never talk about banking. They never talk about anything but the battles and, you know, who the combatants were, which countries were warring against one. Never talk about who profits from the war and how nations are destroyed by Jewish moneylenders. They'll never talk about that. So this is the typical military history. You never get far into the details of who the real conspirators are, the ones who create the wars, the ones who bribe politicians to become traitors to their own country, such as happened in Poland and Russia and elsewhere. Okay? Very little of that. Very little of that in the history books. But we know that was going on. There's all kinds of references to it, especially in Russia. The Bolivars, I think. I'm trying to remember the name of the Russian nobility under Ivan the Terrible. Ivan the Terrible got the nobility in line because there was so much treason going on, or anti-kingdom activity, and deals made with nobles of other countries. So you can only guess as to how many Jews were involved into getting these nobles to become traitors to their own country. So this is what was going on behind the scenes, and very little talk about behind the scenes reality is ever discussed in the military. Nothing about Freemasonry, nothing about the Knights of the Golden Circle of the Civil War, the Knights of the Mystic Crew of New Orleans, who started the New Orleans Parade, and it still continues today. These people were not loyal Americans by any stretch of the imagination. They were loyal to their secret societies. Okay, folks, this is, you can't discuss true history without the secret societies and Jewish moneylenders. If you avoid those two subjects, you're not talking history. You're just scratching the surface. All right, folks, thanks for listening. Take care. Yahweh bless everybody. And we need another Pale of Settlement, don't we? Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Free people will never remain free. if they are not willing, if need be, to fight for their vital interests.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Praise Cavalier and pass the ammunition.
The Restoration Hour with Pastor Eli J.